know what date it was scheduled
for. Yeah.
Of course, they're not having it due to the COVID-19 pandemic. But had it occurred, and we should find out when it was scheduled so that we can, in retro, celebrate that great artist, Janice Marie Scroggins, the Wednesday before the Grand Floor Parade. I hope that this time next year we're back on schedule with all of our cultural events.
Yeah.
And we will be make up for Janice Scroggins' absence this year.
Mm.
Michael Chappiegrass, email at mcg@nothingbutquality.com. Ken and Kevin Berry at the World Arts Foundation and hooked up with the Urban Wings, Aviation here in Portland, in the city. So, hey, Reggae Bob out. Continue enjoying the Juneteenth celebration here Friday, June 19th, 2020. 90.7 KPOO, www.kpoo.fm. And I want to say a big shout out to Guru Sasa. Out.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
This next interview is with Shanice Clark. Shanice is an active organizer here in the Portland community, as well as the Director of Community Engagement for Portland Public Schools. She gave me her perspective about what Juneteenth means to her and learned more about what it's like to organize during the COVID pandemic. Thank you so much for tuning in. Again, this is KBOO's special Juneteenth celebration broadcast. Juneteenth, of course, it's an impactful holiday to have and to celebrate. But how do you think that the fact that it's happening during the this type of turbulent time, what kind of impact do you think that it has?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there's something about having a conversation about Juneteenth beyond those who have before and the years of organizing that has led to this moment where people are just starting to acknowledge Juneteenth as a holiday, as something significant. And I think there's a lot of layers and it's complex. There, you know, the transatlantic slave trade is this big monster truth that our country is kind of still hiding behind, and really why Juneteenth hasn't received that proper recognition, and it means and feels interesting, right? I think there's like this piece of the human dignity of Black folk, Black people in our community that should have been a concern to us all, as our liberation is inherently connected. But I think Juneteenth is definitely a vibe and always has been and will be now, despite current realities. I think that this idea that a slavery was abolished, you know, is an indication that our dignity is of value, even though it feels potentially backwards to acknowledge this day. The idea is that we're supposed to be free, but we're dying. But I think honoring those experiences and the journey to this moment is something that is important to do that we haven't done.
And when you said the word recognition, can you talk about what does that recognition mean to the type of community organizing that you do?
There's so many layers to what that means, and especially as I think about right now, Black folks, we're really not a monolith, and me as an Afro-Caribbean person, and I say we came from the same boat, so to speak. But there is definitely this space that Juneteenth as this landmark, as a moment. I mean, it took over two years for the last slave to know that slavery was abolished. And this idea that even recognizing or acknowledging the fact that this is a thing I'm not sure we have even have done. And so I think now in 2020, what that looks like in a lot of different ways. I know the county and the city have acknowledged Juneteenth as a holiday and are starting this discussion in our communities about, you know, what this looks like to truly do that. And I think it's much deeper. I think it's when Black folks specifically have the opportunity to feel like their fight is valid. And that's at work, that's at play, that's when you eat. So I think that there are layers to how this needs to show up throughout every system and business and structure to truly really feel like it is recognized. But yeah, I think ultimately it's something that hasn't ever happened before, so I think that's an indication that a conversation at least is generating, and that as a Black person existing in this community is more than just in one physical building. So I think that recognition needs deep policy change and ultimately what it looks like to connect with Black-led organizations, Black leaders, and Black elders, in this case, Black youth, to articulate the ways in which recognition could look like. And I think that would be a beautiful outcome.
It would. And do you think that the kind of the intersectionality of so many different groups being affected by, you know, the current systems and the way that everything is structured, do you think that this type of recognition could possibly open doors for other groups and other causes that may have been overlooked?
That's an interesting question. I think the answer is yes, and we have this space here that we're talking about intersectionality and the ways in which we make policy changes for the liberation of Black folks that will also liberate each other, other folks. The ways in which we're talking about policing, for example. And so, yes, I think there's conversations, many, that we haven't had, especially being a Black queer person. To fully feel comfortable is not a vibe that I feel often in this city, that's supposed to be friendly and for folks in different ways. So I think there is a space to have that conversation, but centering it in this way that is anti-racist and anti-Black, at the end of the day, I believe it is what our country, what our community should continue to do, and be in solidarity at the same time with other movements, other struggles, and being able to grapple with those things. But yeah, doors should open, and the gatekeeping should absolutely be dismantled, especially in the context of feeling free, loved, and affirmed.
How do the wrongs that created this state, how do we change them? Like how does that happen?
That's, you know, something I've been processing. I think one thing that's happening regardless is that more folks are beginning to be confronted and or talk about some of these harsh realities and ultimately sometimes fatal in our own community. I think that listening to Black people is always a good idea, listening to our elders, our young Black people, and taking those recommendations seriously. You know, something that white and non-Black people are still working on. But I think that the solidarity for this the struggle is seen, and it's love that I feel and I'm grateful for. And what that means to implement real change, I think, is complex. We're talking about centuries of oppression, and, you know, for folks, you know, theoretically just showing up to the fight, some folks have been here their entire lives fighting. And so what it looks like to truly listen to Black folks who are out here every day, our organizations and our youth, and there's a lot of noise, so sometimes it's hard to hear. But I think a good step is doing that, because there's a lot of solutions that our community has been talking about and organizing for, and sometimes I even forget that. But that's my hot take. I think that there's absolutely room to unpack community-specific strategies and solutions down to the level that impact your neighbor. But I think in a theoretical sense, we have Black organizations, the State of Black Oregon, the PALF People's Plan, reports from a coalition of communities of color. I think there are places to start and people to connect with who have been trying to talk to us, who have been trying to tell y'all. And I think there's a place to start.
There is different types of Black people, you know, and there's different types of African people and African Americans, but it doesn't seem like there is as much a support as other organizations and other people, you know, whether it's funding from the state or different things like that. So now, because of all the protesting and all the organizing that all of the different organizations that you mentioned and Black Lives Matter and all of that, you know, have been protesting, going to the street, there's now money that's being allocated to different organizations that are Black operated, Black run. And do you think that that's a good place to start? Do you think that that can actually make an impact in the future? Or do you think that that's just kind of, you know, kind of money for them to quiet down?
There's going to need to be more than one way to heal. And one way is absolutely if folks are experiencing distress. One example I can kind of remember right now is the Black Resilience Fund is out here supporting folks who are trying to bury their children and or just maintain medications amongst losing their jobs. And so I think there's some realness to how the current day realities of oppression, amongst all of the other things that are going on, really do have a direct monetary impact. But then it's much deeper than that. So I think there's absolutely some value, especially with the ways in which structures haven't really supported organizations in these same ways. This is kind of a part of the work. I think people of color deserve to thrive. They deserve to feel safe. They deserve to have what they need and bury their children. So I think I'm in favor of what it looks like to think about a multi-step plan to the struggle, and that is definitely one of them.
As though organizing isn't difficult enough, you know, doing all of these things and, you know, staying connected and staying on top of everything and figuring out the best course of action, how has the global pandemic change the type of organizing that you do, and has it changed your mission at all?
Yeah, it really has disrupted my life for sure. I think a couple of my family members have recovered at this point, but got COVID, who live in another state. And so that was just a personal struggle of navigating what to do about that and how to support them. And feeling kind of helpless. But I think in the context of organizing, especially, asthma is a vibe in my family, and I have severe asthma. So being out there with tear gas is something, it's not a regular decision I can make. So I've been really trying to be creative with the ways in which I'm showing up and supporting other people. And there's so many people doing work. It's beautiful, actually. And so figuring out my lane and also, just being mindful of my own health has really disrupted what might be ongoing, regular activity in these protests. But I think ultimately I'm finding comfort in getting resources and giving resources to folks who are able to be out there every day.
That's a real concern because the pandemic is still out here, and there are people that have different health conditions or people that they just don't feel safe protesting, whether they're, you know, they're scared of being hurt by the cops or profiled in some way. And can you discuss a little bit about the how you said creating your own lane and like being more creative in how you are still maintaining those resources for people?
I think when I'm able to have the capacity to donating to bail out funds and Black-led organizations, and also connecting with other organizers and leaders who have brought demands forward and or thinking through demands, and really young people are doing a lot of work. If you see out there in the streets, they're out there. There is some stuff on the other side with just checking in with young people and making sure they know that decision makers and other folks are willing to hear from them, especially our Black and brown youth and folks who might be listening through this Juneteenth program and or just processing, that there are spaces and opportunities, especially elected officials and folks at our local school district who are willing to hear from young people and students be in relationship as this change and transition is impacting all of us. And so I know there's been a campaign or several campaigns happening that will really be an opportunity for folks to surface concerns, demands, and be in community with each other. And so I think there's ways to do that virtually, and there's ways to do that in person. And I'm trying to lean in particular into just keeping people safe at this point. So that means if folks need to have access to certain things to do what they got to do, and or engage in these community spaces that are virtual, that ultimately will be linked to policy advocacy and shifts that we will want to implement. So yeah, I think there's a lot of ways you can do it. Art is a whole vibe in movements, and I think writing, visual, audio, there's a lot of different ways that folks have been expressing themselves. And so I think expressing yourself is always a good thing to do, especially because this is traumatic. It's not normal to deal with all of this death and despair. And so coping, I think, is healthy and something we have to do too. Being on work mode, being on all the time, solving centuries of oppression, it cannot happen overnight. And there's just something about humanizing each other through this experience as well. But yeah, doing what you got to do. And of course, if there's some risks that you may or may not be feeling and or having due to the coronavirus pandemic, I think it's okay to show up differently and ask about what other ways you can stay connected to what's going on.
You know, you mentioned the Black Panthers and different organizations in Oregon, and you know, just the history of the Black Liberation Movement. What do you think caused this new wave, this intense, you know, it's not a wave, it's a tsunami, and like, what do you think was the breeding ground for it? What do you think was the, you know, for lack of a better phrase, like the straw that broke the camel's back?
It's definitely after Facebook Live, after Instagram Live, then the conversation shifted. Then an organization called Black Lives Matter was founded, and this whole journey really shifted, I think, years ago. But here today, there's a different shift that we're feeling. And I think a big part of that is the same reason, the ways in which we're able to engage with each other, live broadcast death. And that is something you cannot deny at that point. And so I think there's something about how horrible and direct this sounds, but this is something, especially as Black folk, that we have gotten used to, and it's almost desensitized for some. So I've stopped watching the videos at some point. But I think there's something about just Facebook Live, and it's pretty dualistic in my answer, but I think there's just something about live broadcasting this pain in a way in which you cannot deny it. You cannot deny that it's happening, and we have to sit and deal with it then. We cannot run away from the discomfort or simply dismiss a Black person's voice, because that's the easy thing to do. But we cannot deny this video.
Now, you said that you don't watch the videos anymore, which, you know, at a certain point, it's very difficult to watch. But there are millions of people that are watching these videos, and, you know, some of the people in there could, for some of us, could be our brother, sister, uncle, cousin, mother. So how can a person cope when they see someone who looks like them being publicly executed on Facebook Live?
It's definitely a different experience every time. And I think for me personally, it has become just images that you just don't get to erase, and they become a part of your psyche. So I think on a personal level, just speaking individually, I know that it's happening. The images, they just stick in your head. So I think looking at these videos and these images from time to time, when I'm ready, maybe it'll be way beyond when generally the public has processed it, but the way in which they process it, though, that's traumatic in itself. So it felt like I knew exactly what happened, but I'll be honest with you, I haven't even watched this George Floyd video, but what I can tell you is that I've heard it described in a detail almost regularly, and so it's enough for me. I've seen enough of the videos, and that sounds like one I won't get out of my head for a long time.
Do you think there's something about that video in particular that made people realize the truth?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think there's this notion of a Black man for almost a half hour begging for his life. And it sounds awful. So there are definitely hot takes, quick images that, of course, you might not have a choice in seeing. But I've opted into seeing pictures of him, art of him, his family, and other kinds of images. And those are the ones that I've been opting in more to looking at. But yeah, I think that there is something about the idea of someone begging for their life and for a half hour and the ways in which it was described. Enough that it made this public outcry. So the way that my mental health is set up, I know I'm gonna react to that.
You know, is this a time to celebrate? Is this, do you think, more time to be, like, you know, introspective? Like, what, how can we celebrate knowing all that's going on?
Yes. So I know locally there are a few things happening, some benefit shows and liberation rides. And so I think the answer is, I think for for folks, it needs to look differently based off of where you are. I would love the moment where white and non-black people talk to their families truthfully and wholly about our stories. And that happening on Juneteenth sounds like a pretty appropriate time. I think that black folks in particular, I think they have options on what they should do. I think they should have options, is what I'm trying to say, on what they might do if they want to acknowledge it or if they don't. I definitely resonate with the idea of it feeling backwards due to where we are, especially due to the fact that we're in an uprising. But I think, to what I was reflecting on earlier, I think our dignity is valuable, and recognizing this day is important. Our journey in abolishing slavery is important. It is valuable because we have human dignity, and I think that a part of that is a symbol of how long it took to even get there and how long it will take to continue this fight. Rest is radical, so schedule some rest in when you can soon. But I think there's some space to think about Juneteenth as this space of an opportunity to reflect on the work, especially what's already been done by our elders and ancestors and all these folks, in some ways what they dealt with was identical or worse, which is wild to me. Whatever nuggets are there, I think there's a really good moment, an opportunity to grow in a direction we need by acknowledging this story on Juneteenth. And I think the notion, like, there's this European idea of what celebrating and holidays need to look like, and maybe it's not a day where you get a gift necessarily. Maybe it can be if that's the context in which reparations might be showing up in an environment, but I think maybe it's just a day where you're in solidarity with other folks who, in a way that you need to be.
You know, you refer back to the elders and the work that's been done before, and that's something that, at least on the mainstream conversation, you don't hear much about. How do you think that their input can maybe help the conversation, uplift the conversation, maybe even, give it more strength?
Of course. When we look at today now, these things like slavery that might have been an existence which makes Juneteenth significant, we don't feel that theoretically, but I think that there is some space to acknowledge that present day impact. Elders and ancestors in particular, though, are like really interesting for me to be in relationship with, especially in Portland, because of the history of Black Portland and how folks have been displaced. And there's just so much, of course, because Black folks are rich and beautiful, so much history and dopeness that sometimes white people don't do a good job of telling. And those are a lot of the voices we hear sometimes. And so remembering those things is a muscle I have to work at. And so I imagine that might be for other folks too. It might feel easier, especially when there might be a whole people's plan sitting there that has been as a result of deep engagement, not just with these elders, but the very people in which we're fighting for.
In that sense, you don't have to reinvent the wheel, and it might not feel as daunting of a task, you know?
Right. That's exactly how it feels for me. It's hard. There's centuries of oppression here that we've got to undo. So starting from here and just fixing it tomorrow, I'm not sure I think as a collective, be thinking about that these things exist, and really just people to just get out of the way and let Black folks lead and do their thing.
And is there anything that I skipped over that you'd like to highlight?
Yeah, I'm just really grateful to have this conversation and just think it's so interesting going from when I learned about Juneteenth. It wasn't in school, as in undergrad, from other radical Black folk in our little living rooms, just having a meal and talking, to now where this is a conversation at like the city and county level. So I think that I'm just taking a moment just personally to reflect on how progress feels, even though we have so much work to do. Just holding on to those things is the energy I need. So appreciate this conversation.
Well, thank you so much. And if people are interested in contacting you, is there any kind of way that they can do that?
Yes. Folks can absolutely reach me. My email is my first initial and last name, S. Clark, with an E at the end, at .net. I would love to connect and or, share.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You take care.
Good day.
Bye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is the novelist and short story writer N.K. Jemisin, author of 8 previous novels, 2 short story collections, and a novella. John Scalzi calls Jemisin the most important speculative fiction writer of her generation. And Wired magazine calls her the finest writer of the fantastic of our time. And in light of Ursula K. Le Guin,